Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XL. What is an Emperor Redux? I want you to think about the time that has been spanned in the last XL podcasts of Emperors of Rome. So say from when Julius Caesar became dictator in 49 BCE, right up until when Domitian was assassinated 150 years later. In that period of time, we've seen Rome gone from a republic to essentially back to being a monarchy in everything but name. So what is an emperor now? How has it changed? And what does it mean to hold this power? Here's Rhiannon Evans. Augustus was the first emperor of Rome. Why wasn't Caesar an emperor? And would he have liked to have been an emperor?
Julius Caesar wasn't an emperor. He wasn't the princeps, the first man in Rome, which is what the Romans called the people we call emperors, because he didn't have all of those powers invested in him. He was a dictator. He had a republican role, but he didn't have imperium. He didn't have the kind of authority that Augustus has. So it's quite a complicated question to answer. Also, Caesar failed, of course, in that he was assassinated. But then, as we've seen, some of our emperors are assassinated. So that's not the defining principle. I think Caesar still saw himself in the republican mold. He saw himself as somebody who could exist within republican structures. So the very fact that he made himself dictator indicates he's still thinking like that. Because as we've discussed, I think, but a very long time ago, being dictator isn't the same as the way we use it. It's a role that means that you have the power to do what you want at a time of emergency. And it's a role you're meant to give up. What Caesar does is he tries to play around with the republican roles. So he makes himself dictator perpetuus, which is dictator forever. And that's a bit of a contradiction in terms because dictator's meant to be temporary.
Yeah.
Augustus learns that lesson and he stays within the remit of what might be okay during the Republic, but he starts to accept lots of additional authority and powers. And the big one is the tribunician veto. He has tribunician power. That means he can veto anything that's brought up. And that's pretty much absolute power without calling it that. And that's what makes him emperor. So whenever you look at a coin and it says trib pot, which means tribunician power, that means that man's an emperor.
So did Caesar have that power unofficially?
No.
Okay. So he couldn't do whatever he wanted?
No. Although obviously he also has a lot of authority.
Yeah.
And he has a victorious army.
Yeah, which who's going to tell Caesar no?
Well, the people who are going to tell him no are the ones who stab him. That's the only way to get rid of him.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways you are splitting hairs because Caesar did have an enormous amount of power, but he wasn't called princeps and the Romans didn't regard him in that role. And that's really what distinguishes him from Augustus and the emperors who follow. Also, there's not really an idea that this is a new system, a new dynastic system that's being brought in under Caesar. I mean, he wasn't around long enough to tell, really. I mean, he wins the civil war in 45. He's killed in 44 BCE. So, you know, you have to have the little footnote to everything I'm saying, which says who knows what would have happened if Caesar had lived the rest of his life.
Yep.
He dies in his 50s. He could have lived another 20 years. So Augustus is the one who has the chance to really put that system in place. He's clearly thinking about successors. I don't think anybody would seriously think that Caesar was at the point where he was thinking about successors. His heir is Octavian, who becomes Augustus. But Octavian's 19 years old. Who knows if he's had a chance to prove himself to be something that Caesar might have regarded as a good successor. I don't think he's thinking in that way yet. He's really not assuming that he's going to die the following year.
So what sort of powers additionally does Augustus get when he becomes emperor, and who's giving those powers to him?
He's getting the powers from the Senate, so everything always looks above board.
But is it by kind of knife and coercion kind of?
Well, what you've got to remember is that the Senate has been the other side in some ways in the civil wars against Caesar.
They've been
and
on the losing
Octavian.
Side. Yeah.
Yeah, and the Senate is now stacked with his supporters. So it's a compliant Senate.
So they're existing by the grace of the emperor, really.
Yeah. Exactly. They're existing by the grace of the emperor, and that will continue to happen throughout the imperial period. Now, that doesn't mean that they're always happy with the emperor. They might have been put there by him, but he might then go on to bring in policies or act in a way that makes them very unhappy. And even in the imperial period, there are families or people who are so significant that it's hard to keep them out of the Senate unless you accuse them of something and charge them, which does happen.
Yeah, exile them for arbitrary reason X.
Yeah, or say to them it would be a good idea if you didn't exist anymore, which is a kind of forced suicide. And that's one of the reasons that does happen if the emperor is not happy with the constituency of his Senate. So there's still this rather uneasy relationship between the Senate and the emperor, because there's still this memory that the Senate is meant to have a great amount of authority, which it's getting eroded away throughout the imperial period. And that has been happening more and more. Certainly by the time we get to the end of the period we've got to, there's a lot less authority in being a senator.
By extension of that, is the emperor becoming more powerful? Is it possible for them to become more powerful throughout, say, Augustus all the way to Domitian?
Yes. There's a strange kind of negative and positive effect going on, though, because for Augustus, it's untried waters. Nobody quite knows what's going to happen. On the other hand, there is some pushback against Augustus, but there's no serious contender against him once he comes into power. And you'll have noticed as we're going along, everyone's trying to recall the glory days of Augustus. So, you know, when a new promising emperor comes in, there is this idea that he's the new Augustus. We actually had that with two emperors who turned out just terribly, Caligula and Nero, both seen as quite promising right at the beginning. And Vespasian was clearly trying to recall those earlier days too when he comes in with a brand new dynasty. So there's this idea that Augustus in a way was the most successful one. But technically, in terms of the power that the emperor has, this is rising. So Augustus gets it in stages. He gets what we now call the first settlement in 27 BCE, which gives him a certain amount of power, but really it's in 23 that he's given all of these official powers, and he has absolute power, imperium, as we call it. Emperors that follow tend to be offered it straight up, not Tiberius, not the next one, but as the tradition gets set in, you become emperor, you just have all of that power.
Yeah.
So you have it right from the start. You're not sort of building a new system. So in a way, Augustus had the hardest path to follow because he's creating the system. On the other hand, nobody's really seen as successful as him. Now, this is probably because most of our sources are senatorial, and we always have to bear that in mind. They're always biased. Some of them, even though the power of the Senate is waning, and perhaps because it is, really want to hark back to those days when they had a bit more authority, they had a bit more dignity as they see it, and perhaps even, as in the case of someone like Tacitus, harking back to the days before there were emperors. So they're writing from this perspective, and they might well see Augustus as the one who didn't trample on them quite so much.
Mm.
So we've got this weird kind of tension in which during the first century CE, we've got a system that is very much entrenched. Absolute power falls to one person in each case, and you have to get rid of him if you want to overturn that. By killing him, you're not going to expect him to go into exile. You're not expecting him to give up and somebody else to come to power. On the other hand, you've also got most of our sources having at least a little bit of unease with this system. Somehow it impinges on the authority that they should have. And they all sort of know that.
So is it an arrangement that... arrangement is the wrong word. Is it a situation that only exists for as long as the emperor is a nice emperor? Because if you put a toe out of line, then they could suddenly decide you are not going to be emperor. You know, if you get the military's nose out of joint, it seems that having the military on your side is the key to having a long and successful time as emperor. of course, you know, anybody can go and assassinate an emperor. And it seems that the senators have had a crack, if you want to put Julius Caesar in that category. The lower ranks went and killed Domitian. Take your pick as to who the military have taken out. There's been a few of them. So is it a massive balancing game? Are you only the emperor for as long as Rome decides that you should be emperor?
It sort of sounds like one of those role play games, doesn't it, where you have to keep everybody happy. To a certain extent it is, but I'm glad you brought up the military there, because that's something we should stress. Throughout that century, the military is getting more and more powerful until we saw with Vespasian, in fact, all of the emperors who came after Nero in that year of revolving emperorships, it's the military declaring them emperor, it's their armies. So having an army behind you, having the, hopefully all of the army behind you, is crucial, because if you don't have that, then forget it. It's not going to happen. But it is a matter of keeping everyone happy, because it's not just about the senators anymore. There are more people with something at stake. And one of the reasons that the imperial system works in as much as it does work is that now there are people with something to gain from there being an emperor. So if it's an emperor who is favorable towards the military, and often one of the first things they'll do is double the pay of the army,
right,
something like that, well, you have something to gain from that. They might well be an emperor who goes after military glory, like Vespasian or Titus. One of the things you'll get from military glory as a soldier is spoils.
Yeah.
But there are other people with something at stake, like the people in the imperial household. So the people around the emperor, his wife, his children, his assistants, who are often freedmen. So now we have people with something to gain who are from the very bottom layer of Roman society. And, you know, sometimes they're involved in the conspiracies against them, because there's all kinds of dynamics and personal tensions going on. And maybe if they're no longer favored, if they're not going to have the kind of power they could get through the emperor, their noses will be pushed out of joint. So there's a lot more to keep stable and keep happy. And it's not just about the public persona of the emperor. He also has to play the internal politics of the court, because this is a time when we start to get a court. In a way, it gets more interesting, because you don't just have elite men with power, which you could argue about this, but in a very broad way, under the Republican system, that's what that encourages. There's a small group of elite men who can rise to power. Their wives might have influence over them, and you could discuss all of the ways that that might happen. But it's much clearer that in the imperial system, people in the imperial court have access to power. They can stop messages getting to the emperor. They can sway him. They can plot around him. Mm. So I don't want to make it sound like a soap opera, but there's certainly a much more interesting dynamic.
It sounds more like upstairs, downstairs than a soap opera. There's something to be said for the power that somebody holds, one, who has access, and two, who can go unseen in the background. Can you talk a bit about the different titles that an emperor takes on board? I guess we've got good coin evidence for these kind of things, but they take on different titles based on their victories in some aspects, and different ones mean different things. So pick a few that you like.
Okay, well, every emperor gets to have PM written on his coins, which doesn't mean prime minister or in the afternoon.
Yep.
It means Pontifex Maximus, which is a long-standing role in Roman society, or it's not something invented for the emperors. It means the chief priest.
Who gets that first, sorry, is it?
In terms of emperors, Augustus.
Yeah.
And it's a role that Julius Caesar had had, but it's actually a role that Julius Caesar took on as he was sort of, you know, playing the career path of Romans. It's an important religious role for him, and it gives him a high profile. It means that you're in charge of the Vestals, who are in charge of the Sacred Hearth of Rome. So it gives you this really significant kind of public profile. You look really important. The name actually means that you are the greatest bridge builder, right? Pontifex.
Yeah.
Pons is a bridge. It means you're a bridge builder. And Maximus means the greatest.
The greatest guy who put everything together.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, beyond... the Pope must love that.
It goes back beyond time that we don't know exactly what this role meant in its origins. So it's a very old role.
Yeah.
And you're right, it is a name that the Pope still has.
Yeah.
He's the chief priest of the Catholic Church.
So if anything didn't go the emperor's way, he could just say Pontifex Maximus and get over it.
Well, it gives him religious authority, which is significant in Roman society.
Yeah.
After Augustus, they automatically get this role. All right. So previously, obviously under the Republican system, it's something that has to be voted for. And in fact, interestingly, there is a strong idea that Julius Caesar wouldn't have got this role if the rules hadn't been changed about who gets to vote for it. But that vote had been given to the people, and he was very popular with the people, and that's what made him Pontifex Maximus. Mm. So none of this might have happened at all if the rules hadn't changed and Julius Caesar hadn't been the man of the people. So they get PM, they get Pontifex Maximus. They also get called princeps, which means the first man, the first man in the Senate, technically. But obviously it doesn't really mean that anymore. And in a way, I always think of princeps as a bit of a whitewash. It's a term that means they're not called king, because they're never called rex, which means king. Mm. Never, ever, however late you go, actually, when it's clearly a fiction that we've got any kind of republican system anymore. It's monarchy, but they're not going to use that name. And that goes back to that real Roman allergy to kingship. They think they've overthrown monarchy and they're not going back to it. Mm. So they go back to it, but not in name. They get called imperator, which gives us our word emperor and empire and everything associated with that, imperial. But that doesn't mean emperor. It doesn't mean what we mean by emperor. It actually means somebody with imperium, which is power. It's power to put a Roman army in the field. It's the power that a Roman general has. You need someone with imperium out there. So it often gets translated as general, sometimes as emperor. But imperator, really for the emperors, it means they have authority over Roman armies. They can say, we're going to war against these people. I'm going to lead an army there. Or more likely, you go lead an army there under my imperium. So they've got this kind of military, religious, political power shown through those three roles. But I cannot reiterate enough, the thing they've got, which isn't really a title, but gives them so much power that nobody else need enter the game, is that tribunician power. So when you see it written on a coin, trib pot, the pot stands for potestas, which means power. That means I have the right of veto over everything you do.
Mm.
It's kind of the right that the American president still has, except the Roman emperors had more power than the American president, and they didn't have any term limits. But that right of veto is actually, I think, is something the American presidents keep bolted up most of the time. They don't use it that much, but it's there as a warning. If I don't like this, I can use it. And I think it was sort of the same for the emperors. What's the point of introducing something the emperor doesn't want? He can just use his veto. They also tend to reflect the origins of their power. So most of them will work Caesar or Kaiser into their name, which is why the German word Kaiser comes to mean, you know, ruler, emperor, because it's part of Caesar's name and it gets continued through the emperors. And often they'll take on Augustus as well. So there is that idea of continuing Caesar and Augustus. And initially that makes sense because they're people in the Julian family. All right, the Julian Claudians are related to each other. But when we get to the Flavians, who aren't related to that family at all, they continue to use Kaiser. Then we know that's sort of part of the title. It's not, I'm part of this family. So the word Kaiser or Caesar becomes part of your title. It's not about who you're related to anymore.
The final bit of names that I'd like to touch on is the reflection of putting military victories in your name. So Claudius has Britannicus in his name and names his son Britannicus. Vitellius has Germanicus in his name to signify that he was a great leader in Germania.
I always think of this as a sort of finger to the people you've conquered almost. You're no longer just Claudius. You're the Britannic Claudius.
Yes.
That every time you talk about Claudius, you have to remember that victory over Britain. And this also is not something the emperors invent. It goes back to Republican times. So conquerors of Carthage, the Scipio family in particular, would get the name Africanus, conquerors of Africa. It's a fourth name that you get, although the emperors have far more names than that. But traditionally, the Romans have, or Roman men have, three names. And if you get that fourth one, that honorific, every time you're referred to, your great victory is being referred to.
Yeah.
So it's a big military honor.
Well, surprisingly, Titus didn't take it up.
No, and this is something that Suetonius points out. And that, I think, is meant to be a kind of modesty. I think that's about the Flavians having this balancing act of not wanting to appear too showy. They're new people, they're nouveaus,
yeah,
and they have to tread a bit carefully.
Can we now talk about what happens after an emperor dies? And I'm picking up here my copy of Suetonius's The Twelve Caesars, because here in the table of contents, Julius Caesar, afterwards deified, Augustus, afterwards deified, Tiberius, Caligula, nothing, Claudius, afterwards deified, nothing for a while, Vespasian, and Titus, afterwards deified.
And not Domitian.
No, of course not Domitian. Domitian's a separate kind of thing. But it seems like the bar for being deified was don't stuff up.
And
no. And no. Okay, all right. All
the
right.
Romans did not take this lightly at all. All right. So the first person in living memory who gets deified is Julius Caesar. And it's a big deal. And Augustus says that there was a Julian star, a comet, that appeared at the funeral, and he claimed this was Caesar's soul going up into the heavens. It's sort of the first person since Romulus who is deified. And it's a huge deal. And he gets to be Julius Divus, the deified Julius. The thing that it really means, and I'm sure we've pointed this out before, is that the successor, who's usually either the son or the adopted son, is now the son of a god.
Mm.
So it's kind of more important for the successors and for the way that the dead emperor is remembered. Although, you know, technically we shouldn't call him the dead emperor if he's deified, because they didn't have funeral rites, because they're not dead. Mm. They've been turned into a god. So it is a big deal. It becomes less of a deal because it becomes a little more normalized. It's not normalized by the time of Augustus, although we can tell from reading Ovid that there is an expectation that Augustus will be deified, because he talks about it as something that's going to happen in the future.
So where did Tiberius go wrong, I think, is the way to put this next question.
I would read that as, I mean, Tiberius is not a popular emperor, but he's not murdered, probably not murdered. He has, if not supporters, then people who rely on him. Would it really have harmed Caligula to be the son of a god? It would actually have been quite good for him.
Mm.
I think it hasn't been normalized at that point. I think you have to be Julius Caesar or Augustus to be considered for deification. All right, so maybe it's just not automatic at that point.
Oh, well, I guess the next question is, what tips it back then for Claudius?
An easy way of answering that is to fall into...
He's not Caligula.
The way that, well, there is that, yeah. Being better than your predecessor is always a good look, isn't it?
Yeah.
Certainly the way Tacitus presents Agrippina, who is Claudius's wife and the mother of the next emperor, Nero, is as being very manipulative, and that she possibly is central to engineering the deification of Claudius, because that makes her the wife of a god.
And Nero, the son of a god.
And Nero, the son of a god.
Okay.
And it means they can build a temple to him, that, you know, that Augustus is quite a long way away at this point. It's interesting to remember that Nero lost interest in that, though, and he never bothered finishing the temple even.
Mm.
And remember, he gets rid of his mother 5 years in. Is Claudius really deified if he hasn't got a temple? Nero doesn't really seem to care, and it's Vespasian who finishes that temple. Interestingly, Claudius is the one who deifies Livia. That's quite a while after she dies in 29 CE, and Claudius isn't in power until 41. So that happens, but it happens quite a bit later.
Yeah.
Now, that's important, of course, because she's a woman who's deified. She's in a special position because she was Augustus's wife, but that is another way of making it a bit more normal. It's the imperial family, not even just the emperor, who might come up for this. After that, I think that it does become more normalized if you are a popular emperor. Obviously, for the Flavians, it's a great way of saying we're the dynasty that has arrived. We're doing now what happened to Augustus. All right, so you've got Vespasianus Divus, the deified Vespasian, and the same for Titus. And you can expect it would have happened for Domitian if he hadn't been assassinated and his whole memory wiped out by the Damnatio Memoriae.
Well, let's discuss that now. So that's the complete opposite of being deified, is if you really stuff things up, we're going to scrub you from history.
Mm. There had actually been talk of this with Caligula, but Claudius would not allow it.
With Caligula being scrubbed out.
Yeah, exactly. There is actually evidence of a sort of informal one with Caligula, with some statues being desecrated. But it's Domitian is the first emperor for whom this formally happens. So he had really hit an all-time low. And you're right, it is the opposite. If you're deified, it's not just the idea that you get the title, that you are now a god. It's also that you will then get a temple, so something very concrete to commemorate you. And there will be rituals. There will be a priest. There'll be sacrifices, libations. There'll be a day on which you're commemorated. There'll be statues. It really is a way of living on and having that important spiritual place in Roman people's lives. Damnatio Memoriae is a way of saying, not only are you not living on, you never existed. It's worse than just dying like most people do. It had actually happened to Sejanus, conspired against Tiberius and been executed for it.
So it had happened occasionally.
Yes.
But not on the scale of an emperor.
No, no, no.
It didn't happen all that often after it.
No.
So did the emperors, a few of them obviously thought that they were gods.
During their lifetime.
Yeah, during their lifetime.
As we saw, that's what Domitian was accused of.
That's what Domitian was accused of. I seem to remember Nero stalking around his palace at night, commanding the sun to come up, which I suppose it did listen to him eventually every night if he kept it up long enough.
Yeah, and Caligula was supposed to have that strong association with Jupiter, the Greek version, and thought of himself as Zeus, perhaps.
Mm.
If Suetonius' representation is to be believed, there do seem to have been emperors who kind of flipped over to that side where they thought that they were amongst the gods.
They believed their own PR.
Mm.
Yeah. So after the death of Domitian, and there were a couple of times before this that I think that this could have happened as well. Why doesn't the Senate ever reassert its power and say, right, that's it. We're done with emperors. Nero, you were great, but we're now just going to become a Senate again like we were in the good old days. They had an opportunity to do that after Nero. They definitely had an opportunity to do that after Domitian. Why didn't they take it?
Well, I think in some ways we've answered some of that in a roundabout sort of way in that, A, the military is very powerful now. What does the military have to gain from the Senate getting back into power? Nothing. B, the system eventually becomes normalized.
So it's institutionalized at that point.
Tacitus does say at the death of Caligula that the senators were just too slow.
Mm.
The Praetorian Guard had come into the palace, found Claudius cringing behind a curtain and said, "You'll do." It's a very kind of broad way of putting it, but this idea of that particularly the Praetorian Guard needs an emperor because they guard the emperor and that's their job and what are they going to do if they don't have an emperor is to a certain extent true. There are lots of people with something to gain. The Senate is not all against this idea. They also benefit from certain emperors. Even Tacitus, who is our most cynical and apparently anti-imperial voice, anti-emperor voice, writing in the early second century, he had a great career under Domitian. He hates Domitian. He writes nasty, horrible things about Domitian. Domitian is despicable. But part of what he has to try and cover up is that he did very nicely under the Flavian emperors. You know, he got to rise through the career path. He plays it very well. So there's plenty to be gained. I guess everyone starts to find their place. One big thing we should mention is that the next level down from the senators, the equestrians, from the time of Augustus, are being promoted. They're getting more responsibility. They're actually getting to be in charge of whole provinces in some case. So Augustus, very cleverly, I think, sees that building up the next stratum of Roman society gives him that kind of buffer of people who need him and will support the emperor. So the Senate doesn't really have a leg to stand on because there's not that many people who want them back.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If we made it onto your Saturnalia list, we would love a review on iTunes. You can like the podcast page on Facebook, where we're coming up to 2,000 Facebook fans, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Domitian is dead, the Senate acts quickly, and puts in power a 65-year-old senator named Nerva. He has no heirs, and he's coming towards the end of his career. Is that a good decision? You have to wait and see in the next episode of Emperors of Rome. Or you can cheat and go on Wikipedia right now. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.